heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to My Science Project. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And today's show is going to be a fun one, I think. This one, we're going to get into this hot and trendy world of food called molecular gastronomy. And I got a real kick out of that because all it is astronomy with a G added in front of it. And you can eat your experiments. I'm not quite sure what could be better than that. Today is a food show. We're looking at the science of cooking, and this falls under the umbrella of molecular gastronomy. I had the good fortune of chatting with Dominique and Cindy Duby of Wild Sweets in Richmond, BC, and they are some extraordinary scientists in the kitchen who make chocolate combinations that you've never thought of before, and they approach it with a really sciencey attitude. They've provided us with a sciencey summer recipe, and by the end of the show, you'll know how to make ice cream without the ice cream maker, and no, this is not the recipe with liquid nitrogen, so stick around to hear that. We'll have a look at the molecular basis of flavor combinations as well. And I need a drum roll for this, but I don't have one because at long last, there it is, at long last, I'll be joined by Julia today, who's the regular alternate co-host for My Science Project. And not too long from now, Julia will join us by phone from Calgary. So I'm pretty excited about that. We don't often get to do these shows together anymore. As usual, you can get in touch with us by emailing myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. And so I hope you'll stick around for the show and hear about molecular gastronomy, hear the crazy stuff that Julie and I have picked out of the news about food. So shortly Julie will join me, but I have to maybe embarrass her slightly by announcing that it was her birthday yesterday. And I want to honor her birthday with a tune about food, one by Sibo Matto, and this is called Birthday Cake.
Easily, can we just say, shall I be? So what, shall I, for your own sake? Do you slicky. So I say, well, for my own sake, watch out, yo, here come you. I'm gonna change your rattle sake. Turn up the TV, do you agree? Yeah, I'm taking turkey, taking hold of me. I'm gonna show my love for my dad, but it's moldy, mom, isn't it? Extra sugar, extra salt, extra oil, MSG. Extra sugar, extra salt, extra oil, MSG. Shut up, blend it. Don't mind the pumpkin. Shut up, blend it. You know my love is sweet. Shut up, blend it. Don't mind the pumpkin. Shut up, blend it. You know my love is base.
Hi, welcome back to CITR 101.9 FM. This is my science project, and hopefully I'm joined by Julia. Julia, are you there?
I am indeed.
That's great. Welcome to my science project with me this time.
Lots is new. I had to turn my speaker off because there's a big delay over the internet.
Okay.
And I was like hearing the music and you're talking and I got all confused.
That's an interesting little experiment itself. I wonder if we could measure that delay.
We could indeed. I'm sure another show.
Well, I'll just let you get adjusted in that way. But, you know, one of the things we wanted to start out talking about is an update on the postdoc situation. And, okay, that doesn't have something to do with food exactly, but...
Except being able to pay for it.
Except for being able to pay for food, indeed. And it's just something that we wanted to get back into because we've spent quite a lot of time on these issues. And not long ago, we even re-aired the show that we initially did on postdocs here in BC. And cross country, and it's you know a really important issue because there are some really key issues that keep coming up, and seem to be a bit challenging in that career path. But we have good news today.
Finally,
at last. The good news is that for the first time since 1997, the University of British Columbia policy describing the terms and conditions for postdocs is being revised.
It's taken a lot of doing, hasn't it?
Yeah, it has. It has done indeed, and it's long overdue, I guess, if it's been 10 years since it's been examined. But this is known as Policy 61, as a matter of fact. I don't know how we got that low rank of Policy 61, but it's sort of a standard policy that would deal with all aspects of the job position, including recruitment and selection, compensation, benefits. Whether postdocs are involved in teaching, grievances, and all that sort of thing. And what they're doing is they're assembling a task force, and postdocs will be included in this task force, to revise this entire document as necessary. So, you know, the news that I wanted to get out here today is that, you know, postdocs who have comments on this particular document can have their voices heard. Probably the best way to start would be to be a part of the Postdoc Cafe at UBC, which you can contact at postdoc-cafe@interchange.ubc.ca. But there's going to be sort of a group set up there for talking about this issue specifically. So I think it's great news that in due course we'll have a revamp of the policy for postdocs.
And it's coming out of the Office of VP Research, right?
Yeah, that's right.
So that's another way if people want to get involved and can't remember for the email mm-hmm. or whatever, they can contact that. And I think it's worth noting that, like, why should anyone care about postdocs? Why in the general public even should they care? And it's something that was talked about in the show, that the bulk of science is actually done by postdocs. And we are the ones who are taking public funds and using them in the lab and helping to train grad students and managing stuff. So as far as what the public is paying for, you know, we're kind of the hands that are doing a lot of it. And so if we're happy and working in a good environment, then we're producing more, we're using the money better, and everyone's happy.
That's a fair point. I guess before we leave this, I just thought I might mention some of the three key issues, basically, that have come up again and again with respect to postdocs and their job description. And one of them, unsurprisingly, is compensation or salary. But it's a particular challenge in the postdoc community because postdocs are involved not just in scientific research, but also research in the domain of the humanities. And there tends to be quite a lot more money available for science research. So sometimes is an imbalance in the salaries between those two fields, and is certainly worth looking into whether that can be rectified in any way.
Absolutely.
Another issue is benefits, and that's one that we talked about extensively in our previous show at My Science Project, and it's an issue here because postdocs who have their salary from University of British Columbia are caught up in the very generous benefits plan from UBC. But surprisingly, if you have a scholarship to do postdoctoral research, you're set free from that benefit opportunity. So you don't get the same benefits as you would if your salary was paid from another source. So that's, for obvious reasons, created some problems. And the final issue has to do with your appointment. At UBC, you can only be a postdoc for 3 years, and while I won't get into the details of that, it's an issue with some very strong pros and cons, so another thing that needs to be examined. So again, for any postdoc who wants to contribute to that discussion, you can do so by checking out the Postdoc Cafe at postdoc-cafe at interchange.ubc.ca, or to come through, we said the Office of Research. Is that right, Julia?
VP Office of Research, the Vice President Office of Research.
Yeah, so that would be another angle.
Yeah.
So that kind of puts a happy note on the plight of the postdocs that we've been featuring quite a lot on My Science Project. But like we said, the focus of today's show is going to be molecular gastronomy. And so we're going to be looking at the science of cooking. And Julia, I think you were going to kick this off with a couple of fun news items on science of cooking.
I am indeed, and there one story is particularly interesting for me. I'm not sure why, because I don't cook with alcohol that much, but it's a question that I think lots of people have wondered about, and that's how long does it take for alcohol to boil away when you use it, and how much of it actually is left? Does it all go? And I found this on a website. It's www.ochef.com. And one of their tidbits in the site is that very question, does alcohol really boil away in cooking? And it's a question that was submitted by someone who was reading the website, and they thought that this was a no-brainer. Like, I would have assumed that most of it boils away pretty quickly. But with some experimentation, they found out that this actually wasn't the case. And I'll tell you why. And they referenced a book that's called The New Making of a Cook, that's available in Canada and also in the UK, if anyone's listening online from the UK. And the author of The New Making of a Cook is Madeleine Common. And she, in this book, cautions that a dish with wine has to be cooked for long enough to remove the harshness of the alcohol. So in other words, that sort of that alcoholy taste that you get. She wants to get rid of that, although that doesn't address whether or not the alcohol remains. So Madeleine Common suggests that you simmer and reduce the wine separately from the sauce and then add it in. But anything beyond that, she doesn't give any details like how long you need to do it. And that was part of the trick of these people on this website, was finding out more information and like the fine details about how much goes away and how long it takes. So the next step that they did was they tracked down a book called Sauces that, again, was published in Canada and Britain. And this is by James Peterson, who's a cookbook writer who studied chemistry at the University of California at Berkeley. And James Peterson is a bit more specific. He says you need to cook a sauce for at least 20 to 30 seconds after adding wine to it to allow the alcohol to evaporate. Now, the authors on this website say that that does make some sense, because apparently alcohol evaporates at 172 degrees Fahrenheit, which is 78 degrees centigrade. So any sauce or stew that is simmering or boiling is certainly hot enough where the alcohol is going to evaporate off. But they still weren't satisfied, and they kept looking, and they found that when they flambéed food, the flames would last for at least a minute, which implies that it's still burning alcohol for that amount of time. So then they proceeded to do some other work. And although the conventional wisdom accepted by pretty much everyone is that all the alcohol that you add to a dish evaporates or dissipates during cooking, they found that that's not at all the case. And why is this important? Well, it's important for various reasons. For example, if you're a recovering alcoholic and you want your food to be absolutely free of alcohol, this has implications for the food that you eat. If you have any kind of religious concerns about consuming alcohol, it's also relevant, or any health issues that you're pregnant or anything else. It's important to know whether or not you're consuming food that has alcohol still in it. So, in fact, the upshot of all this work is that you have to cook something for a good 3 hours to really eradicate all traces of alcohol. And some cooking methods are less effective at removing alcohol than if you just let the food stand uncovered overnight and have the alcohol just evaporate off. So, just to wrap this story up, a study conducted by the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Nutrient Data Laboratory calculated the percentage of alcohol that's left in a dish based on various cooking methods. And for example, if you add alcohol to a boiling liquid and then remove it from the heat, 85% of the alcohol is still there, which is a huge amount. It's 15% that's still left. And apparently if you bake something that's been stirred in, that has had alcohol stirred into it, if you bake it for 2.5 hours, only 5% is left in. But that's pretty amazing when you think of how much time.
Yeah, 3 hours is extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really quite something else. So where the harshness of the alcohol, that taste that tells you that alcohol's in there might burn off very quickly, the actual alcohols in there themselves stick around for quite a long time.
I think what that story demonstrates also is one of the key principles of molecular gastronomy, and that's that you can do research relating to food. And, you know, you cited several studies that examined exactly that. You know, this common notion that you can boil away alcohol in, you know, a couple of minutes. They tested that hypothesis and came up with some interesting results.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, like, it's fun with food. It's science fun with food. How much better can it get?
And I suspect they tasted a few of their concoctions just to see if they could taste the alcohol.
Yeah, well, as you do. It's rough, right? Someone's got to take the hit. Do we have time for another story?
Yeah, why not throw in another one?
Okay. So this is one that I'm kind of, it's a bit self-indulgent, and I think for me the joke of this story is that it's a paper published in the European Journal of Physics. It was published in 2002 in volume 23, and it's a paper that was written by someone named A. Leike. The author is Dr. Leike, because this was an experiment that could be used in the classroom to demonstrate the principle of exponential decay. He didn't say exactly what level of school, but I'm presuming we're talking about like 14 to 17 kind of high school years. So this experiment, which is recommended for the classroom, is demonstrating the exponential decay law using deer frost. I wish that I'd had this guy teaching me physics in my classroom. And without getting into the nitty-gritty equations, which I think just don't translate all that well over the radio, essentially what they did is they had a cylindrical beer glass, and they measured the height of the beer glass, and then they had three different kinds of beer, whatever brands they liked. And unfortunately, they poured the beer at 19 degrees centigrade, which is warm beer, which is kind of gross. So I guess you wouldn't want to drink it after. But they had the glasses, they had the measured heights, and they had their different types of beer. They poured the beer at the same temperature. And then what they did pretty much immediately, because the beer foamed up straight away, was they then measured the rate at which the foam went down. And they then track this over time, they track the heights, and then they could, of course, track the quote-unquote decay of the beer frost. And I think most people would think of exponential decay in the context of a radioisotope, where the thing breaks down over certain periods of time, like by half increments. So if you have uranium, for example, I don't know what the decay rate is, but you lose half of it in 50 years and another half and blah, 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 and on from there. So the idea was with the beer foam that they could track the increment at which it decreased and calculate it, and then, I don't know, drink the beer at the end.
I like the concept of a half-life, a beer froth half-life. Because that's a term that's commonly used in terms of radioactive decay.
Yeah.
Some have extremely long half-lives, like you said, sort of half a year, half a century or even longer, but also some of the more common ones used in the lab have a half-life of a matter of days or weeks. So the half-life of the beer.
So this is something that you can, hey, after the next Café Sion, you speak at the Railway Club?
Yeah. We can do an ongoing experiment.
There are many different types of beers to try.
With that, I think I will turn to another song about food, and another song from Sibo Matto, a great band, always singing about food. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about a complete definition of molecular gastronomy, and also some of the poisons we eat almost every day. Jump the gun there a little bit, but we'll be quickly getting to a piece about flavor that that derived from an interview I had with Dominique and Cindy Duby. But just for now, I promised that when I came back, I would tell you a little about some of the poisons we eat every day. And I'm not talking about herbicides, that pesticides that may be coating the plant food that you consume or otherwise. And I'm also not talking about recreational drugs. Instead, I'm talking about poisons and toxins that exist naturally. For example, you may have heard the old wives' tale or you know, folklore that apple seeds contain cyanide. And in fact, they do. It's found in the form of amygdalin, which is a sugar cyanide compound. And it can be degraded to cyanide when it's metabolized. And it's not just apple seeds that have cyanide in them. It's also cherries and peaches, those seeds, as well as apricots. And the obvious catch with something like a cherry or an apple is that you rarely consume the seeds in high enough doses for it to be serious. And, you know, you'd have to eat an inhuman amount of those to have cyanide poison. And also the human body is fairly efficient at detoxifying small quantities of cyanide, which is a good thing, because if you get cyanide in your blood, it can essentially lead to asphyxia because it prevents the carriage of oxygen in the blood. And on that note, it's not just apples, but it's actually also cigarette smoke that has quite a high level of cyanide, as well as developing reagents for photography, as well as acetone products that are used to remove artificial nails. And it's also found in the almond family. So cyanide, yeah, eating it almost every day. In fact, I had an apple on my way over to the station. And there's actually quite a few examples of chemicals in common foods. For example, rhubarb has oxalic acid and it's toxic to the liver. Nutmeg actually possesses a chemical that has a hallucinogenic effect if you have it in just the right amount. But of course, if you have too much, it can lead to serious side effects that include death and heart attacks. So, you know, you don't really want to be experimenting with that one too much. But in fact, the chemical makeup of the compound found in nutmeg is extremely similar to ecstasy, although it's never really had too much popular favor as a recreational drug because of all the side effects. So, you know, we have a whole example of common foods that do have levels of toxins in them that we can consume quite easily. So I quickly want to move into a little bit from our interviewees. They are Dominique and Cindy Duby of DC Duby Wild Sweets. You can find out a lot about all the amazing scientific kits and tools that they use at dcduby.com. That's dcduby.com. And they are molecular gastronomists, shall we say. And what I wanted to do is just quickly tell you about the definition of molecular gastronomy. And it has a few components. One is science. It's involved in investigating culinary and gastronomical proverbs, sayings, and old wives' tales, which is something that we've touched on already today. And it's also got a scientific component whereby you explore recipes and the theory behind recipes. For example, you know, what is the relationship between temperature and sugar? How quickly does it take for froth to disappear, as Julia discussed before? But it also has a heavy component of technology because it promotes the introduction of new tools into the kitchen, as well as inventing new dishes based on the science. And the final component of it, which I think is great, is there's an education component that promotes the use of molecular gastronomy to help the general public understand how science can contribute to the well-being of society. And this definition has derived from the very first PhD thesis on the subject of molecular gastronomy, and that was successfully awarded to Dr. Hervé Thys, who is at the Collège de France in Paris. And he continues to conduct research into the science of food. And like I said, I had a great conversation with Dominique and Cindy Duby of Wild Sweets here in Richmond. And we had a great discussion about flavor. And I'm going to introduce that to you just now.
For us, it's different. It's just that we've always been interested in the science aspect. When I went to high school, I studied physics and chemistry. That was what I wanted to become because my father was a chemical engineer. So I always had that sort of background and interest. But then after that, I thought, well, this is going to be a long while, so I wanted to travel. So then I decided, well, I'm going to go and become a chef because that's going to be much quicker, and then I'll be able to leave and I'll be able to travel the world. And then after that, he just got back to me, and then I was interested again, and then we studied nutrition and other aspects, and always into more into the academic side of things. And then eventually we said, well, this new style of cooking is exactly what we wanted to do. And this is something that we've been doing for many years, but never really knowing it. There was no name for it. And so if you told people that you did science-based cuisine, then right away they look at you like, you know, you're that weird alchemist or whatever. And then they think that you're taking the art away from cooking, and then it's not cooking anymore.
Cindy, have you also been using science all along to support your cooking?
No. Well, I mean, I've always been in pastry, and pastry is a lot more different than cooking.
Mm-hmm.
Pastries, you have to be more precise. If you add way too much baking soda or, you know, any one ingredient, you can, you know, not have a great sponge. But no, I haven't really been into science. Dominic's kind of the guy out there who tries. I mean, we've always mixed different flavors and tried different things. Like we did strawberry and licorice. We did like different kinds of combinations in that way, but not so much. I'm definitely not really a science geek. I'm just kidding.
Well, you just mentioned these flavor combinations, and it sounds like a bit of an experiment when you're putting things together and tasting your output. But, you know, there's millions of things that could go together in combination. How do you decide what to use?
We just do it. I mean, we think of the flavors and the combinations, and it's definitely different between Dominic and myself. We have very different preferences. I mean, we did a job for a company, a consulting company in Asia, and they wanted us to come up with sort of European desserts, but with an Asian flair. So we had come up with combinations of, like, making a rice pudding with lemongrass, so vanilla and lemongrass,
mm-hmm.
as a cake, and it was just, to me, it was just fantastic. And Dominic says, oh, you know, we'll mix apricot with Szechuan pepper. And because I don't really like Szechuan pepper, I sort of was, well, you know, do you think they're going to like it, you know? But we made it, and I didn't like the cake. It was, it wasn't my cup of tea, I guess you'd have to say, but we went there, and it was very, both cakes, so we had both. 10 different things that we had done, but we made those two cakes and we gave it to everyone. Everyone had to taste it, like, and they had a bake shop, they had a tea room, and the guys in the pastry shop, and it was very not funny, but I mean, all the men love that cake. But in pudding one, is none of them liked it. So it must be that Szechuan pepper must just turn people, like, it must be a man's flavor. I don't know. It was just very funny because all the women liked the lemongrass in one, but did not like the apricot and Szechuan. So it's, I always go, like, when we come up with ideas, we always go with it because we know that, you know.
Our mantra is that everything works until it doesn't. So we, actually, before, our approach was a lot more sort of trial and error. And we used to have sort of I wouldn't say it's a guide or it's a dictionary or anything because there's no such thing. But there is certain flavor compatibility that are already established. So, for example, strawberry and cream and fish and chips and all those. And today, they actually are trying to find out that, and this is where we started to become a lot more interested in, from a scientific perspective, that there are certain aromatic molecules that are in both of the strawberry and the cream. And they have one molecule that is in common. And the more of the same molecule is in both of those products, the more likely that they will be compatible with one another. So what the new style or the new approach of flavor profiling is actually to try to identify which type of aromatic molecules are present in each of these type of foods, and then combining them based on that amount or that percentage that they have. And then you can come up with flavors that, for example, caviar and white chocolate, or cauliflower and cocoa powder. All of those have similar type of molecules and or identical, and then when you put them together, it just works.
That's really interesting.
A different way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm. It's almost...
Sorry?
You could potentially imagine defining flavor combinations without even really looking at the food, just looking at the molecular level.
That's right.
What's present there.
And that's one of the things that scares away traditional chefs,
mm-hmm,
or classical chefs, because they feel that for them they would go by tradition, And so if the flavor fish and chips, for example, was a very good or strawberry and cream was a very good flavor that was established over the years by tradition, then it would continue on and maybe explore slightly maybe with raspberry and cream or with red currant and cream and seeing if it might work, but they stay within sort of the same family. And I'm not saying that there's anything wrong with that, but why not being able to look at it and to say, but why do they work well together? And then after that, see how we can enhance the process and explore so many other opportunities or so many other flavor combinations that one would not have thought. And then for them or for chef, then they would think that now they don't need to be a chef anymore. You could just be a chemist and you could be a great chef because all you have to do is just knowing what's in the product and then you mix them up together and then you can come up with some great flavor combination.
Is that kind of research going on at UBC at all?
Well, that's one of the things that we are trying to do, and we have talked to a few of the professors, but the group of students that we work with is undergraduate, and this is more of a graduate, postgraduate study, because it involves more of, it's a much more involved type of process, and a lot of it is done with gas chromatography, and there's one machine at UBC that have a sniffing port, so you can actually, you have still to be able to sometimes to recognize what some of the aromas are. So those type of machines, it's quite expensive to do that type of research. So it has to be, it would have to be definitely a graduate or postgraduate studies. And right now it's mostly, we work only with undergraduates.
And what sort of projects are you doing with the undergrads?
We did, the last one we did is a hot ice cream. So basically it's the idea that if you have a regular ice cream where it's, the mixture is frozen and then you lick it when it's frozen and if you let it cool down or warm up, then it starts to become liquid. So we wanted to invert the process where while it was solid, it was hot. And then when it starts to cool down, then it would become liquid. So the complete opposite of a regular kind of ice cream. But it was presented on an ice cream cone and the mixture was scooped with like a regular ice cream scoop. So it had a very similar type of presentation. It didn't have that little skirt that you normally have with the other one, so we couldn't get that kind of presentation. But it was very much the same as an ice cream. It had the same melting properties. It looked very similar to it, and it was very neat.
How hot was it?
It was
65.
Yeah.
Oh wow. Did it have a particular flavor? Or was more of a textural experience?
We made it
mango.
Mango ice cream. But it was a cream.
Thank you very much. Nikki's song is my favorite.
Hi, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and this is my science project. And I'm having some trouble with the transition between pieces here today, but apologize for that. We're talking about molecular gastronomy, and I'm joined by Julia in Calgary, who is the regular co-host, or rather alternate host, of My Science Project. Julia, are you there?
I am indeed.
Yeah, so in that piece we just heard Cindy and Dominique Duby, and they touched on their approach to flavor combinations and how the molecular basis of flavor combinations is being discovered further and further. And Julia, I think you found a little something about that too.
I did find a little something. I thought this was really interesting. I don't know why. I think left-handed and right-handed molecules are really cool. They're called stereoisomers, and essentially they're exactly the same structure. They're just reflected. And in the case of smells and tastes, this can play a really big role in how we interpret smells and tastes. And this is your own dead easy experiment that you can do in the privacy and comfort of your own home to understand and to test out stereoisomers and how they affect your nose. And all you need to do is you need to get one orange and one lemon, so two citrus fruits, and you need to grate the peel off each of the lemon and the orange separately, and then you need to smell them. And lo, you will smell one is like an orange and one is like a lemon. And the reason for that is that lemon and orange are stereoisomers. In fact, the orange is the left-handed version, which basically it's like a honeycomb with one arm at the right and kind of three branches at the left. And the lemon is the right-handed version of the molecule, so it's got its three branches on the right-hand side versus the left. And orange and lemon are not the only food scent stereoisomers out there. In fact, you can do exactly the same high-tech experiment using caraway seeds and mint leaves, where you basically grind up the seeds and grind up the mint and take a whiff. The mint is the mirror of the caraway. The mint is the left-handed, and the caraway is the right-handed molecule. Kind of similar to the citrus. In fact, they just kind of have an extra arm on, you know, the same side where you just have one branch. They have kind of a second one coming off the honeycomb. And why is this? Why does the mirror, the reflection, make a difference in how we interpret the smell? The reason for this is that the receptors in our nose are also configured to pick up these different structures. So the orange molecule, for example, the left-handed stereoisomer, fits into a left-handed shaped receptor in the nose. And the same thing with the lemon, it fits a right-handed one, which begs the question of how we even develop these receptors for all these different things, which is a whole other show, I think, in future. But that's a quick and dirty lesson in these impacts that left and right-handed mirrored molecules have in how we interpret our food.
It's really incredible how such small differences can mean the difference between lemon and orange, or even just a small difference can switch a flavor taste from lemon to mint. There's really not all that much varying at the molecular level.
And, you know, I want to throw a question out there, which is, you talked about how cyanide is found in almonds and cherries. And I don't know if you've ever done this, but have you ever had a cherry flavor and then thought, like, pretended you're eating almonds?
I'm not sure that I have.
Next time you have, like, a cherry liqueur or almond marzipan, pretend you're eating the opposite. Like, if you're eating cherry, pretend you're eating almond, because I swear it's the same taste.
I'll have to try that. It's really incredible, though, what role your brain has in the food that you're eating. And I talked about this a bit with Dominique and Cindy, and how you can pick up a clear glass of liquid and tell yourself, this is water, and you're going to dive in and have a drink. And then you find out that actually you're drinking Sprite or 7-Up or something that would have a similar appearance. But there's
Or vodka,
but as you do in the morning. But there's sort of a lag effect in how long it takes you to recognize that it's not actually the water that you thought it was. So I think you can your brain can kind of trick you into it, to expecting a certain thing with food, and it's certainly something that gets played on a lot with molecular gastronomy. And one thing Cindy and Dominique play with a lot is chocolate. And in the next little segment of our show, we're going to hear a little bit about what it is that they get up to with chocolate. Leading into that, here is I Want to Eat Choco Bars from Shonen Knife.
Thank you very much. Nikki's song is my favorite food song. I Want to Eat Choco Bars.
Students improve their standings in math and English on provincial exams? Would you like to improve your own skills for teaching and leadership? Do you plan on entering the PDP program or law enforcement, youth work, BSW, or medicine? Volunteer as a tutor in an innovative program at QE Secondary School in Surrey in this midweek after-school program. In its 12th year, it has proven to be a rewarding experience for students and volunteer tutors. Contact Ms. Bond at 604-581-3476, 604-581-3476, or email bond_ats@hotmail.com.
You're You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And you're also hearing a whole lot today about molecular gastronomy. I was speaking to Dominique and Cindy Duby of DC Duby Wild Sweets, an incredible chocolate connoisseur's heaven. And in this next piece, I spoke to them about chocolate.
Chocolate is divided into different components, the two major ones being the cocoa butter and the cocoa liqueur. The liqueur is kind of like the cocoa powder that is being hydrated back again with the cocoa butter so that you have this fluid mixture. You have to think of cocoa butter as the cement. The more cocoa butter you have in chocolate, the more firm the chocolate will be. So, for example, if you're making a chocolate mousse and you want the mousse to firm up quite well, then you would use a dark chocolate more than a milk chocolate or white chocolate. Because you would have more cocoa liqueur, which will make the mousse maybe a little bit drier, and you would have also more cocoa butter, which will make it firmer, so it will set on its own. If you're using a milk or white chocolate, typically you have to add gelatin, because the gelling, quotation gelling power of cocoa butter is not strong enough. So you're adding a little bit of gelatin inside, and then the gelatin will firm up the mousse. If you're baking with chocolate, like Cindy was mentioning, the heating is very important. If you overheat it, you burn the not the cocoa butter, because cocoa butter has a very high smoke point, but the cocoa liqueur burns very quickly. So you have to be careful on how you do it. If you do it in a microwave, definitely go into short intervals and mixing every time in between. Otherwise, it'll look like it's not even melted, but you have one big huge chunk in the middle of the container that'll be completely burnt.
What do you think the future of chocolate is? You both are constantly coming up with amazing combinations. Do you think you can predict where we'll be in 5 years' time?
But chocolate is more like wine, the wine industry. If you look at the wine industry in the 70s in Canada, for example, it wasn't very good, and they didn't really have to worry all that much. But then when they started to deregulate, and then there was a lot more competition and so forth, then they had to come up with a much better product. And the quality has risen so much, and that's why we have things like ice wine, which puts Canada on the map for one of the great wines of the world. And I think that when it comes to chocolate, Canada is not a cocoa manufacturing country, but neither is Belgium or France. But they do buy the beans from other parts of the world and then bring them up and then process them and then sell them as Belgian or French chocolate. Canada doesn't have a manufacturing company that makes chocolate like Calbo and Cocoa Berry and so forth do in Europe or Lindt or in Switzerland or whatever. So we don't have that history sort of thing. But we have access to all of those products. So where the novelty, I guess, has to come in is from the creativity of the person who makes a new product from there. Like when we see sometimes people making a chocolate bar, and then all they do is they buy these chocolate from XYZ company in Europe, they bring the chocolate over here, they melt them down, and then they put them into a new shape or whatever, and they say, now it's my bar. And then they call it their own kind of product. But it basically, they just bought the product and melt it, and that's it. So there's no, to us at least, there's no creativity in doing something like that. If you're going to make a chocolate bar, then it has to have something else in it that really distinguish and promote the creativity of the person who made that bar through the addition of a filling or a combination of the filling and maybe a flavoring of the bar or the chocolate itself or whatever. But it can't just be melting up something else. Everybody can do that.
Mm. Are there any flavor combinations or sort of chocolate challenges that you're trying to work on at the moment?
Yeah, we're launching a brand new line of chocolate bars, and I guess your listener will have the exclusive preview.
Great.
It's going to be called an arome, and it's based on the systematic grouping of aromas used in the perfumery industry. So each aroma is divided per letter. So, for example, if you have, just looking here, C for citrus, and the bergamot, lemon, lime, all of these notes are divided into this letter. F would be for fruit, and G for green, which would be like olives and herbaceous notes and so forth. H would be for herbs, and you can have like lavender and thyme and so forth, and S for spice or clove, cinnamon, V for vanilla and so forth. So what we are going to do is to make a chocolate bar that will have a shell made with a 70% Ecuador-type chocolate, origin-type chocolate, and then inside it will have a filling made with a nut. And we use an infusion of a similar type nut. So, for example, if it was the citrus, we'll have an orange and sunflower oil infusion with a sunflower praline, which is, and this one is a seed, not a nut, but where you make a caramel, and then you add the seeds into it, and then you grind them up until it becomes like a peanut butter kind of consistency.
Mm-hmm.
And then that will be flavored with the infusion of the sunflower oil with the orange. And then it will be mixed together and then piped into this bar. So when you're eating, it's chocolate, but the filling would have a texture and an aroma. Because we're looking as well to perhaps making it sort of a nutritional aspect, looking into different kinds of tocopherols that we can add to the product, as a stabilizer, the antioxidant properties of tocopherols for fat-type products, as well as the natural levels of tocopherol that is present in either the seeds, nuts themselves, and or the oil.
You're listening to My Science Project, and that was Cindy and Dominique Duby of Wild Sweets talking about chocolate and making me extremely hungry. I don't know about you, Julia.
Yeah.
Could go for a chocolate bar right now. But one of the great things about molecular gastronomy is that it takes place in the kitchen, and just about any of us can do a little experiment in the kitchen. And just to finish off the show this evening, both Julia and I, via DC Doobie, have an experiment or two for you to try. So, Julie, what have you got?
I've got something from the NakedScientist.com. They're a group that does some radio and stuff in the UK, and this is how to extract DNA from a kiwi fruit. So if you have never seen DNA, never handled it, here is your chance to extract your own DNA from a fruit. And it's really simple, and you don't need much. In fact, pretty much everything you need is found either in your bathroom or your kitchen. And the first thing you need, of course, is a kiwi fruit, or lacking a kiwi fruit, you can use an onion. You need some liquid detergent or hand soap. You need a little bit of salt, 2 grams, about 100 mils of tap water, and the same volume of ice-cold alcohol. So you can just go to the drugstore, buy some, stick it in the freezer for 30 minutes and get it ice-cold. You need a kettle, you need 3 jars and a large sink, and you need something to pound the heck out of the kiwi with, and a sieve or coffee filter paper, and the last thing you need is a knife, and of course, when you use that, be careful. And what you need to do is just basically, like, peel the kiwi fruit, get rid of the dead skin, and chop it, and put the chunks of your kiwi in the jar and mash the heck out of it. The more that you mash, the more DNA that you'll get. And then what you need to do is make a solution of your liquid soap, 5 grams, your 2 grams of salt, and your 100 mils of tap water, and you need to stir it slowly until the salt dissolves. And of course, if you shake it, the soap is going to bubble up, and you don't want that. But what the liquid soap does is it dissolves the fatty outer membrane of the cell, so it lets you get at the DNA. And the salt itself makes the DNA stick together and clump so that you can see it when you extract it. And this solution of the liquid soap, the salt, and the tap water is what we call, in scientific terms, the extraction buffer. So what you do is you add this extraction buffer solution to your mashed up kiwi in the jar, and then you mash again. And the more you mash up, again, the more DNA that you're going to get. And the second to last step is to incubate your kiwi and buffer mixture at 60 degrees centigrade for 15 minutes. So basically, you're going to fill your large basin or sink with boiling water from a kettle, and then use a thermometer and add cold water to adjust it down to about 60 degrees. And this incubation step also helps to break up the cells further and starts to degrade some of the cell's proteins. And lastly, what you need to do, or I guess second to last, is take out your jar from your incubator, filter the kiwi mixture through your sieve or your coffee filter paper into a clean other jar, and then you need to take your ice-cold alcohol and slowly pour it down the side of the jar, and the alcohol then forms a transparent layer on top of the kiwi mixture, and you end up getting where the alcohol meets the kiwi mixture, a white jelly-like substance should form, and that is, in fact, your DNA. And you can make a hook out of a paper clip or whatever to hook up your DNA and play with it.
Something we've always wanted to do.
Absolutely.
Now, where did you get that recipe/experiment from?
This is available from www.thenakedscientist.com, or if you want to email us at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca, we'll be happy to email you the recipe or the link.
Now, I think I'm going to go straight into the next recipe science experiment to try at home, and this is one from dcdoobie.com, and they are describing in this next little segment a way to make ice cream without an ice cream maker. But Julia, you and I will be back together on air in 2 weeks' time.
We will.
Shall we reveal the topic of the show?
Oh, let's.
Over to you, Julia.
We are going to do the science of poo.
Did someone just say poo? So we're going to regress a little bit for the next couple of weeks.
Yeah, yeah. And we might even throw some monkey poo in there, if not around.
Roll our eyes with bathroom humor.
Yeah. Well, after a show on food, you know, it's in and out. The circle is complete.
Very nice, very nice. Well, thanks for joining me on air today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
So here is a recipe for ice cream without an ice cream maker. And of course, our interviewees couldn't help themselves from explaining a little bit of exactly what's going on. And following on from that, we'll finish with a little Canadian tunage from Rufus Wainwright, Cigarettes and Chocolate Milk. Thanks for joining us, My Science Project. See you in 2 weeks' time. Bye-bye.
Bye.
What we had done before was an ice cream, but it's basically like 600 ml of milk, 400 ml of whipping cream, 100 grams of corn syrup, and then around two tablespoons, depending how chocolatey you want it, of cocoa powder. And then you just boil that on the stove all together. Then you strain it into a pail, and then you leave it in the fridge until overnight is best. And then you just take it out, and then you can put it on like a KitchenAid with a paddle, and you add dry ice pellets or crushed dry ice into it, and just let it mix until it gets about
a kilo or so.
Yeah, about a kilo. And then you just mix it in, and you just keep adding it in slowly as it mixes. It just sets like ice cream. Or I mean, you
have to make sure that you continue to stir. So you can actually, if you don't have a stand up mixer, you can do it with a spatula.
Yeah, a rubber spatula, and just stir it by hand.
Okay.
So if you're by yourself, then you could take like a cloth or something that is a non-stick surface, and then you put your bowl over it so when you're mixing, it's not moving around.
Mm-hmm.
And then you, like Cindy said, you put all the mixture in the container, and so try to get something that is quite a bit bigger, so at least three times the volume that what you put in. So if you have a 1 liter of mixture, then have at least a 3 to 5 liter container.
Okay.
So that you don't, once you stir around, it's not going to overflow. And then you can divide the 1 kilo of dry ice into two,
mm-hmm.
and then put them in between a kitchen towel or something like that, and use a rolling pin or whatever. So that's why it's better to buy the pellets, because it's already much smaller. And then add half of it in the container, and then you have to be very quick. Like, you got to stir all the time. And then just as you, the whole idea is that as you're stirring, you're doing the same process as the churning in an ice cream machine. But the difference is that the dry ice is much colder than an ice cream machine, and it forms gas as well, too. As the dry ice evaporates and it comes in contact with the liquid, it forms the gas, and then it traps some of these little bubbles as it freezes. So that's the same thing as the churning process, where it's a process called an overrun, where you're incorporating air inside of the mixture as it freezes so that it expands. And an overrun is typically calculated by volume. So if you have a 1 liter of liquid, or the base custard, and then you have an overrun of 130%, that means that once you finish your ice cream, you put it back into the container, you should have 1 liter and 300 by volume of this from the same 1 liter mix.
Great.
So typically an overrun for a good ice cream should be around 130% or so.
Cigarettes and chocolate milk. These Is it just a couple of my cravings? Everything it seems I like's a little bit stronger, a little bit thicker, a little bit harmful for me. If I should buy jelly beans, have to eat them all in just one sitting. Everything it seems I like's a little bit sweeter, a little bit fatter, a little bit humble for me. And then there's those other things, which for several reasons we won't mention. Everything about them is a little bit stranger, a little bit harder, a little bit deadly. Scrappy boys' faces have general run of the town, playing with prodigal sons. Takes a lot of sentimental valium. Can't expect the world to be a raggedy Andy while running on empty. You little old dog with a frown, you gotta keep in the chocolate milk. Cigarettes and chocolate.